Hello and welcome to this audio version of eConsultancy's e-commerce trends quarterly for Q1 of 2025. And it's our roundup and analysis of the big news that we've seen in e-commerce. Just to firstly introduce myself, I'm Lynette Saunders, a senior analyst here at eConsultancy, and I'm going to act as your host for today. And I'm joined by the author of our e-commerce trends quarterly, our own very talented Rose Key. Rose, do you want to introduce yourself and tell our listeners a bit more about our e-commerce trends quarterly if they happen to be joining us for the first time?
Of course. So hello, everyone. I should be a familiar voice to any of you who've listened to this podcast before. But I'm Rose Keane, now Content and Insight Director here at eConsultancy. And I'm also the regular author of e-commerce quarterly, which, as you mentioned, Lynette, is our roundup of relevant news, trends, and importantly, analysis of what's happening in the e-commerce market. So really bringing that, what does this mean for me, layer to all of those headlines.
Great. And I think for me, I found this quarter particularly interesting because there seems to be a lot happening, and we do start with that, the global politics, the impact that it's having on e-commerce. But I think more importantly, it's the uncertainty that it's been causing. Now, since our last e-commerce trends quarterly, for anyone that tuned in at the end of 2024, we obviously now have the Trump administration in place in the US. And as you highlight, Rose, they've been very busy, particularly around what's happening in terms of tariffs. Now, you do point out it does raise questions for businesses, particularly who picks up the cost for these. But I think what was interesting, you do talk about one particular beauty brand who's been grappling with this question. So I'm going to ask you to tell us a bit more about how they've responded, but also just generally, what should brands be thinking about with all the current uncertainty?
Yeah, so there's certainly a lot going on, which might be a bit of an understatement. I mean, as we point out, actually, really, this is the biggest story in e-commerce at the moment and business more broadly. So that sort of general sense of uncertainty. But as we sort of mentioned, this is spilling over into things like the decisions that are getting made by businesses, as well as also things like consumer confidence more broadly. But as you mentioned, one of the case studies we feature was a New York-based beauty brand called Borges. So they've made this pretty difficult decision to actually stop taking orders from their international customers. Now, this is not a small loss. It actually cuts them off from around about a third of their direct customer base, so 30%. Now, the thinking behind this was essentially it was to prevent the very real possibility of a customer who, let's say, is based in Canada, perhaps ordering a product, maybe something like moisturizer for around about $50, and then getting hit with a surprise $200 charge because of things like tariffs. Now, that's obviously a rather sort of extreme response, but I do predict actually we'll see more small and medium-sized brands responding in a similar way. And this will likely spill over into things like consumer behavior. I mean, after all, none of us wants to get stuck with a surprise multi-hundred dollar charge when we make an order from our favorite retailer or from a particular brand. Now, for those brands and retailers who are looking to respond to this situation, there are a few different courses of action available, apart from just sort of stopping shipping entirely. Of course, these don't do away with the impact of tariffs, but they may at least start to reduce some of the burden of that unpredictability. So international warehousing is, of course, the big one. But this does, you know, require quite a lot of investment and will also require some time to spin up. And then we have also partnerships with local retailers. But the third, and I think this is probably the most vital and also the quickest to implement response, which is just to bring in some clear communication for your customers before they purchase. So being really clear about any potential charges they might incur, as well as the potential for shipping delays, because that's something else we're seeing as a result of all of this uncertainty and all of these sort of political moves.
And I think that point around the communications is so key. I mean, I think we've all got that shopping basket page or checkout. We're just about to press the button and none of us want to obviously be surprised by additional costs that are showing there. But I think as we've sort of pointed out in the quarterly, there is, you know, lots happening. So definitely, I think, watch this space as well. But we've also seen further impact of import regulations on Temu and Shein, the proposed end to the de minimis tax exemption on packages that were valued under $800. Now, it was a loophole that, again, we seem to have seen that things happen, things change. It had been temporarily closed by the White House in February. They've reinstated it for the time being. But this is an integral part of the business model for these platforms, isn't it, Rose? And I think, you know, they're certainly looking at this imminently as closing as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting situation. So I think it's fair to say that the de minimis sort of exemption was not designed for huge e-commerce platforms to be shipping thousands of parcels internationally. So I don't think it's an unfair move for the US government to look to close this loophole. I mean, it was actually something that was put forward in the Biden administration originally. And of course, as you say, it's a sort of started being implemented under the new administration. And just as a sort of an example of the sort of way in which retailers in the US feel about the de minimis exemption, and the clothing retailer Forever 21 actually blamed their most recent filing for bankruptcy. They have done it before, but their most recent one, which was this month, on the advantage that de minimis had given their rivals, the advantage that de minimis had given their rivals like Shein in terms of things like costs. So as I say, I think it is reasonable to look to close that loophole. Having said that, the handling of it initially has been not the most straightforward. And we had situations with sort of parcels piling up at different airports, and USPS also brought in sort of a temporary ban or halt on delivering packages from China because they just weren't set up to collect those fees from the eventual recipient. But in terms of the responses from the likes of Temu and Shein and the sort of other sort of Chinese-based ultra-cheap cross-border retailers, it will require a shift in their business model. We are starting to see some of the moves here. So Temu, for instance, is already reportedly starting to bring in some of these changes, most notably asking merchants to ship their own goods in bulk to US-based warehouses, which is a real change in the way in which they do business. Now, this sort of the rise of the likes of Temu and these sort of other ultra-cheap cross-border platforms has really been one of the biggest stories in e-commerce over the last few years. So now that these platforms are really facing quite significant headwinds, at least in the US, it is going to be really interesting to see what that does to the competitive landscape, how other retailers will respond, and indeed the opportunities this maybe creates for brands that are not shipping from China.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, it's again that interesting landscape. We do talk about them a lot because lots keeps changing. So we will no doubt be following up in the next quarter as well on any other sort of progress.
That's definitely a shifting sands situation, 100%.
And something that we do like to talk about, whether it's our digital shift or our social quarterly, is what's happening around generative AI, you know, bring the insights for our listeners and readers, but also particularly for our e-commerce trends quarterly, what it means for retailers. Now, in terms of generative AI traffic to retail sites, certainly from some of the figures that we're talking about in this quarter, we have seen that growing. We are seeing consumers, I think you'd agree, get increasingly comfortable with generative AI. But rather than focus on the consumers, I just wanted to, I suppose, ask you more about the ways that we're seeing these tools support retailers, merchants. In particular, and I do love the name of this one, Walmart's bot Wally. So can you tell us a little bit more about Walmart's generative AI bot Wally? But particularly for those retailers out there that are working with Walmart and perhaps have not yet delved into this area as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It is quite nice to shift our focus from perhaps those challenges to these opportunities. And anyone who's heard me talk about generative AI, particularly when it comes to retail over the last couple of years, will have heard me mention about the fact that I think by exclusively focusing on that customer facing stuff, we're actually missing a large chunk of the opportunity. So Walmart is really a leader in terms of adoption of generative AI within the sort of retail sector. And that is both in terms of the customer experience, but also behind the scenes. Now, one of my favorites, which we actually covered in a previous e-commerce quarterly, was their partnership with Pactum, where they created this bot, which was specifically designed to negotiate with suppliers. But as you mentioned, Lynette, this quarter, we're actually covering a launch of a new bot, one called Wall-E. It is spelt differently to the Pixar character, but does wonder whether or not there was a sort of a touch of inspiration there. But the really interesting thing about Wally, apart from its name, is that it's designed specifically to help buyers understand both their stock and their sales data. So, for instance, this might be the factors that are behind where a stock is perhaps overachieving or underachieving. It's also designed to help support with things like forecasting. Now, given that retailing success, particularly at the kind of scale that Walmart does it, is increasingly a data game, plus the fact that data skills and capabilities has actually been long one of the sort of the clearest skills gaps that we've seen and actually been one of the most difficult to bridge as well. You can see how a system or a tool that allows people to interrogate those complex data sets via natural language is pretty appealing as an idea. Now, I do think there is a huge opportunity here and one definitely worth exploring. But I do also feel like I would be remiss if I didn't share a sort of small watch out here. And that is specifically around skills. So in the full written version of this, we cover a really interesting study which came out from Microsoft in partnership with Carnegie Mellon University, which essentially showed that the more people use generative AI for their work, the less they tended to engage with critical thinking, which is obviously a risk given that these tools can do things like hallucinate and reliability is really still a challenge. However, the finding from that research that I found most interesting, and I think this is an interesting shout out or watch out here, and I will keep banging this drum, is that this risk, that risk of just accepting whatever the machine tells you, whether it happens to be right or wrong, was lessened if the workers had a good degree of their own knowledge or a high degree of confidence in undertaking the task itself. So essentially, the better they felt they were able to do the task themselves, the less likely they were to simply just rely on whatever the tool told them, whether it was right or wrong. So what this really means is for solutions like Wally, rather than reducing the need for skills and capabilities and things like data and analysis, they instead really increase it. So whenever you're investing in a new technology, whether it's generative AI or really anything else, it's really important that that is partnered with also investment in skills.
Now, I think that's a really interesting point, and I'll give a shout out for your own report as well, Future Marketing Rose. We do delve deeper into generative AI, and I think a key point that we highlight, that Rose highlights in the report as well, is really looking at, you know, where these tools add value. And, you know, you've highlighted some there, but also the fact of the importance of the soft skill critical thinking, which you also touch on in the report. So I think, you know, what we've sort of covered there and what you're covering in the quarterly trend sort of tie quite nicely back to our future marketing report as well, for anyone who wants to delve a bit deeper into generative AI. Now, I think another key stat that did stand out for me from this quarter's update is 8 out of 10 UK retailers are reporting that social is now the fastest growing commerce channel. But I think what was also interesting is it's the mid-sized brands that are being more active in driving shopper engagement on social commerce. So that was actually quite a surprise for me. And we're seeing the larger brands are more likely to focus on the creative side and the influencer partnerships. Now, you know, perhaps we've got people out there that might be small, medium, large. Any advice that you would have for brands looking to increase engagement in social commerce, Rose?
Absolutely. So social commerce is actually one of my favourite topics to talk about because I think there's still a lot of untapped opportunity here. But in terms of those stats, so that came from a survey by Scurry, which talked to different retailers and brands who are sort of active in social commerce. And I did think that difference in approach was really quite interesting. Now, in some ways, it kind of makes a degree of sense. You know, influencer marketing is a much more established discipline. So I can imagine that those large organizations, they probably already have a framework in place or perhaps a department who's responsible for influencer relationships. And there are some advantages of working with creators. You know, they tend to be pretty good at navigating the platforms. And also by their nature, they tend to be pretty good at engaging their audiences. But if you just exclusively focus on sort of the creator or influencer side of things, I do think that misses a degree of the opportunity here. So, Lynette, as you know, earlier this month, I was over in Athens for a conference about e-commerce, which was a really great event. But I got talking to a really interesting woman who is a social commerce expert. Now, she was talking me through some of the approaches that have really worked for the brands and the retailers that she works with. Now, of the examples she shared, one that really stood out to me, and this is one that I think would be interesting to our listeners, whatever size company they happen to work for, was this large UK-based retailer who found that the most successful hosts for their live shopping were not creators or influencers or celebrities, but instead their own employees. And the question here was, you know, after all, who knows your products better than your own internal experts? So I think there's a real opportunity there, and I think one that a brand should look to perhaps experiment with.
I think that's a great example, a great advice. And I think back to, you know, the early days, we started in social media, you know, we looked for those internal brand ambassadors. So it's great to see that, you know, we are continuing to recognise their importance and the key role that they can play. Now, just as a, I suppose, a final story, which does sort of follow on from talking about creators and influencers as well. We've touched on uncertainty for e-commerce and a story that we talked about in our recent social quarterly trends update was, of course, what's been happening with TikTok, you know, the reversal of the US ban, but also the fact that their future is still uncertain in the US. And we've seen a lot of their focus turning to their shop. But also you touch on the introduction of their automotive ad offering, Rose. So for those that are wanting to keep up to date on, you know, what's happening with TikTok, what they're doing, any sort of final thoughts to bring people up to speed on the TikTok side of things?
Absolutely. It has been pretty active. But starting with the US potential ban. So as you say, they did get a sort of a temporary respite, but the future is still very much up in the air. Now, the main response we've seen here from TikTok, at least so far, has been a focus on European expansion. So over the last few months, they've launched in Spain, in Ireland, Germany and France. Of course, they were already present in the UK. Now, for a lot of those nations and regions, e-commerce isn't really as an established sector or market as we see in the UK and the US. So even with that sort of focus on expansion, which they've definitely put some extra pace on, it still may take some time for the likes of a TikTok shop to gain traction here. Now, equally, as a sort of an aside to that, or perhaps to balance that out, we have seen repeatedly that TikTok has been able to do things like shift consumer behaviour. So perhaps it won't take quite as long as perhaps we might anticipate. Now, in terms of expansion, as you mentioned, we've also seen some sector expansion here with experimentation in other areas, and particularly here, the launch of the automotive ads, as you alluded to, Lynette. Now, for those looking for a deep dive on that topic, we actually have a more in-depth article on that topic going live on Monday. So do check that out if you want a bit more detail. But for many, it might seem a bit like an odd combination, you know, TikTok and car brands. But TikTok has really successfully established itself as a go-to platform for all different types of content, but particularly things like buying guides. So perhaps it's maybe not that strange after all. Now, the other point I wanted to make out here or point out here is the presence of these video or carousel ads, which are the two formats that TikTok offers for automotive companies, might be some way from you purchasing your next ride through TikTok shop. But what it does do is further integrate social content further into and further along the automotive customer journey. So if you happen to be working in an automotive brand, this is an area I would pay special attention to.
Great. And particularly as we've got our article coming out as well. So, you know, do read deeper into that for anyone who wants to know a bit more. Now, just before we wrap up, Rose, I did want to put you on the spot. Always like to do this at the end. What's exciting you then about the coming months? And what should brands watch out for? Since, you know, we've already talked about that e-commerce is certainly an area that's seen a lot of change at the moment.
That's a great question. So of all the stories we covered this quarterly, I think the one that I'm most interested in and one that I would perhaps recommend that brands watch particularly carefully is the impact of things like tariffs and also that closing of the de minimis exemption. And this is particularly when it comes to things like competitors and the way it might shift the competitor set. Now, there is a question here. You know, will it reduce the pressure on retailers who've lost business or customers to the likes of Temu? Now, the other likely consequence of this, you know, as shipping from China becomes more expensive, is that that will cause things like the business model for resellers on platforms like Amazon to start looking less inviting, which may, then change the sort of competitor set for brands on those platforms, at least in the US. So I think it's worth paying, you know, particular attention to the way in which these things might have further ramifications, the sort of ripple effects of those changes.
Great, and a great note to finish on, and also to encourage people to come back to the next quarter to find out the latest as well. So thank you so much for your time today. Always an interesting conversation when we get to sort of delve a bit deeper into some of these topics as well. And I, you know, like to just say again, another excellent e-commerce trends quarterly update from yourself. For anybody that would like more on e-commerce, you can of course read the full trends quarterly, which is available on the link where you downloaded the podcast. But you can also find our previous editions, plus lots of other interesting articles, trends, interviews. I've mentioned our future marketing report, forthcoming articles that we've got coming out as well. So all easy to find on the website. So with that, just wanted to thank everyone for listening, and we look forward to you joining our next quarter's e-commerce trends update.